Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Apologies for the slight delay, for which you can blame Gordon Brown, who detained the chairman a little bit. It's a great pleasure for me, both as director of the LSE and as a former chairman of the Financial Services Authority, to welcome Chairman Donaldson to the school this afternoon. When I was at the FSA, I once tried to add up the number of opposite numbers I had in the United States. And I think we ran out at number 75, and that was before we discovered that Elliot Spitzer was also one of my opposite numbers in the United States. But of course, preeminent among those financial regulators, without any doubt at all, is the chairman of the SEC. Indeed, I like to think of the chairman of the SEC as one of the three great powers in the United States, alongside the owner of the New York Yankees and the host of NBC's Tonight Show. But sadly, of course, Johnny Carson, the most distinguished holder of that particular office, died only at the end of last week. Bill Donaldson is no stranger to academia. His own alma maters were Yale and then business school at Harvard. But of course, what he's best known for in the academic world is for being the dean, the first dean of the management school at Yale. And over lunch, I was asking him just how you managed to put together a management school within a distinguished academic institution like Yale that didn't have one. Any similarity, of course, with the issues we face at the LSE is completely coincidental. But he, therefore, is no stranger to the academic world, and we're delighted that on a brief visit to London on the way to Davos, he has asked to come here to the school to deliver a speech. We have read something about it, maybe, in today's Financial Times, but that may turn out to be quite wrong. It usually is. So I'm delighted now, without any further introduction, to hand over to Chairman Donaldson. Thank you.
Thank you kindly. I'm delighted to be here. As Chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, for those of you that have heard Chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission speak before, I have to start off by saying that the views that I express here are my own and do not necessarily represent those of the Commission or its staff. I've said it. With that formality aside, let me begin with an observation that's sometimes heard in discussions about liberalizing international commerce. Feelings about free trade, it's said, are the same as those about heaven. Everyone wants to get there, but not too quickly. I want to thank Howard Davis and the London School for hosting this event, for giving me the opportunity to speak today. It's an honor and a pleasure to be at an institution with such a rich and varied history, serving as a place of study or research for 13 Nobel Prize winners, including Frederick von Hayek, more than two dozen heads of state, including John F. Kennedy, and one former student in a category of his own, Mick Jagger. We're all familiar with the dramatic expansion of global business and foreign direct investment in recent years, but less well understood is how national regulation impacts the world's security markets and the importance of regulatory coordination and cooperation among the world's security regulators. Given the substantial amount of cross-border holding, capital flows, and transactions, such as mergers and acquisitions, all regulators have much to learn from their foreign counterparts. Indeed, while the SEC is proud of the regulatory system in the United States and the work we do to maintain and constantly improve it, I hope, I am the first to acknowledge that we don't have all the answers. We are anxious to listen and to learn from ideas advanced by other regulators, which is one reason why the SEC is an active member of IOSCO, the International Organization of Security Commissions. In the same vein, we also seek to hear from all manner of interested parties to advance a constructive dialogue and to maintain strong and vibrant capital markets in the United States, in Europe, and throughout the world. It's in that spirit that I'd like to talk to you today about a number of pressing issues facing security markets throughout the world, with an emphasis on the comprehensive U.S. corporate reform law of 2002, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, looking at how it's working, how it affects foreign issuers, and what we're doing to ensure a level playing field in the U.S. market for all issuers, regardless of their country of origin. For the past few years, much of the media coverage of business has revolved around financial scandals at some prominent, once-respected companies. You all know the list: Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, HealthSouth, Tyco, Cedent, and others. In the beginning, these financial scandals appeared to be primarily an American phenomenon, perhaps a result of overheated U.S. stock markets, excessive greed, and a winner-take-all business environment. More recently, however, it's become clear that the U.S. companies were not alone when it came to scandals. Over the past 18 months, we have seen many non-U.S. companies, Parmalat, Vivendi, Hollinger, Ahold, Adecco, TV Azteca, Royal Dutch Shell, Cebu, China Aviation, and others, accused of managerial fraud, accounting irregularities, and other governance abuses. Related to these disclosures of alleged gross corporate malfeasance, there is also a more widespread erosion of standards throughout our markets, with questionable practices becoming accepted and ethical concerns being cut on too frequent basis. The net effect has been to undermine the faith that investors have in the integrity of the world's capital markets. When investors buy shares in a company or purchase its debt, they must have faith that the company's financial statements have been prepared using high-quality accounting standards designed to accurately reflect the company's financial condition. If investors don't have that faith, they will insist on a risk premium for their investment. The cost of capital will increase for those companies, with the obviously negative impact on investment and employment decisions. As it becomes extremely time-consuming for investors to distinguish the good from the bad, they will tend to invest in other markets or perhaps not invest at all. This is a particular concern in the United States at a time when more than half of our households have some equity ownership and investment decisions on the deployment of retirement funds are increasingly being delegated to the individual beneficiaries. It must also be of concern for investors, businesses, and regulators throughout the rest of the world. Different countries have responded differently to the problems in the world security markets, but what's significant is that there has been a global recognition of the need for reform. This is critical because simply fixing problems in only one market can result in their reappearance in other markets. Though multilateral cooperation, we cannot just learn from each other, but must also raise standards throughout our markets and ensure that investors everywhere have the protections they need and deserve. The American response to the problems I've just outlined came in 2002 when the United States Congress and President Bush enacted the law which has become known as the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. The act is the most significant piece of securities legislation passed since the Securities Act of 1933 and 34, the latter of which created the Securities and Exchange Commission itself. Sarbanes-Oxley created a new public accounting oversight board to oversee the audit profession. It created new rules to protect auditor independence and the direct conflicts of interest faced by security analysts. It increased the penalties for financial fraud and gave the SEC additional human resources. The act also instituted other important safeguards, such as requiring issuers, CEOs, and CFOs to certify the company's financial statements and mandating that auditors certify the adequacy of the issuer's internal controls. Now, 2.5 years later, some critics claim that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act goes too far. In particular, these critics charge that requiring certification of internal controls, the so-called Section 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley, is too expensive and unnecessary. Section 404 has even led some foreign issuers to declare that they may wish to leave America's capital markets altogether rather than have their internal controls certified. It is easy for an individual issuer to look at the cost of compliance with U.S. federal security laws and just plain balk. But the cost of capital also comes with benefits. U.S. capital markets are deep and liquid. Nearly half of all the world's equity shares by market capitalization trade in the United States, and non-U.S. investors have approximately $4.5 trillion invested in U.S. stock markets. Since the 1930s, the U.S. has required some of the most extensive financial disclosures, backed up by one of the most robust enforcement regimes of any jurisdiction in the world. As a result, the average person in the United States who saves even a little money doesn't feel that the only realistic investment opportunity is a government-insured savings account. Educated investors recognize that investing in the stock market entails risk, but the U.S. government has worked to ensure there is a range of investor protections and a level playing field. These laws, regulations, and enforcement activities make the U.S. capital markets attractive to foreign investors. The requirements of Sarbanes-Oxley cannot be evaluated, in my view, in a vacuum. They are important because they've produced and will produce improvements that help to restore and reinforce investor confidence in our markets and lower the cost of capital to issuers. Section 404, for example, reaffirms that U.S. legislators are serious about internal control requirements. It is already clear that Section 404 is helping to strengthen the business operations of those U.S. and foreign issuers who have seized the opportunity to use internal control assessment as a managerial opportunity and not simply a compliance exercise. The disclosures that have been and will be made under 404 involve facts that investors should know about a company when making an investment decision. But these are also facts that the management and the board of directors should know about the companies for which they have responsibility. This discussion of Section 404 is a reminder of the need for high standards in securities markets throughout the world. The overwhelming majority of investors, regardless of their nationality and regardless of where they're investing, demand honesty and integrity. They demand that boards of directors take their fiduciary duties seriously. They demand that companies have the internal controls they need in order to ensure the accuracy of their financial disclosure. And when there is fraud or where security law or regulations are violated, investors rightly expect regulatory authorities to aggressively pursue enforcement action. All capital markets, of course, talk of honesty and integrity. Full, accurate, and timely disclosure of material information is a core principle of IOSCO. Strong fiduciary obligations for corporate managers and directors are now enshrined within the OECD's principles for corporate governance. These measures are helping to raise standards throughout the world, but I still believe that there are distinct benefits to listing on a U.S. exchange and registering with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. I'd like to explain why by drawing a parallel to the United States Marine Corps, which shares some characteristics with the Royal Marines here in Great Britain. Of all the U.S. armed services, the Marine Corps has the longest and most intensive basic training for both its officers and enlisted personnel. The Corps is upfront about its grueling physical and mental drill, but it has no problem meeting recruitment goals. The reason is simple. The Marines are an elite, the best of the best. That is what we hope the U.S. market will represent as well. We want listing and registration in the United States with its extensive requirements to signal that the issuer is committed to the highest standards. We also seek to have a listing in the U.S. signify to investors throughout the world that this company is willing to make the investment necessary needed to meet these standards. Companies who choose not to come to the United States may meet those same standards, but our registrants have taken the extra step of telling the world that they are up to the challenges that accompany a U.S. listing. It's entirely consistent with the principles underpinning Sarbanes-Oxley reforms, who also evaluate whether the rules and regulations we write to implement these principles are effective and appropriate. Have the rules been implemented the right way? What are the relative costs and benefits? Are there certain situations in which rules should not apply, or where old rules have been outmoded or in need of revision? For instance, we've recently proposed reforms to the rules governing the so-called quiet period in the weeks preceding initial public offerings, reflecting the advances made in modern communication methods, such as the Internet. There are many other areas where we have acknowledged the need for updating and modifying rules, and there are also examples related to non-U.S. issuers. In this same vein, the SEC has worked from its earliest days to accommodate foreign issuers and to facilitate their access to our markets. In 1935, just 1 year after the SEC's creation, the Commission issued a rule exempting foreign companies from our rules governing both proxy statements and reports by insiders of transactions in their company's securities. More recently, many issuers have raised excellent points and real concerns about how Sarbanes-Oxley will be implemented in practice and how this implementation may affect those who are listed in more than one jurisdiction and who operate under more than one set of rules. The SEC remains committed to a level playing field for all its issuers, foreign and domestic alike, but we recognize that cross-border listings frequently entail issuers having to navigate duplicative or even contradictory regulations in different jurisdictions. While the SEC is unwilling to compromise where investor protections are concerned, some duplicative or contradictory regulations can compromise those protections and place an unnecessary burden on issuers, firms, and investors. I want to emphasize here this afternoon that the SEC is determined to avoid such situations wherever possible. We've demonstrated our willingness to work with foreign regulators and market participants to reduce the likelihood of this occurring and continuing uncorrected. One recent example is the SEC's rule regarding the composition of audit committees of listed issuers. Sarbanes-Oxley required the SEC to pass a rule mandating that all members of an audit committee be independent directors. But the corporate governance laws and regulations in places like Germany, for instance, and a few other countries with dual board systems require corporate audit committees to include a labor representative. SEC rules do not, however, consider employees of an issuer independent for fear that an unscrupulous corporate officer could appoint employees to the board who were beholden to the company's management. Following a dialogue with the European Union and others, the SEC was reassured that in those jurisdictions with dual boards, the mandatory labor representatives on issuer audit committees were firmly independent of the company's management. The resulting final rule relating to audit committees contained an exception for those jurisdictions that would allow employees who are not officers of a company to sit on the audit committee. This enables the affected issuers to comply with both sets of laws, and it preserves the intent of Sarbanes-Oxley to ensure that independent directors can communicate directly with auditors without management interference. Another example of the SEC seeking to accommodate the special circumstances of foreign issuers came with our rules related to the publication of financial information presented in ways not strictly in compliance with U.S. Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, or GAAP. In this area, we included an exemption for non-GAAP communications outside the United States, even where those communications reach the U.S. We took the action because we did not want to interfere with the regular practices governing how foreign companies communicated with investors in the U.S. in non-U.S. markets. Third example of our accommodation is our work with the new Public Company Accounting Oversight Board to iron out some issues regarding oversight of foreign audit firms. Under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, all audit firms, including non-U.S. audit firms, providing significant audit services for issuers listed in the United States, are required to be registered and inspected by the PCAOB. Because of potential conflicts with foreign privacy laws and blocking statutes, the PCAOB has made some adjustments in the information requested of foreign firms during the registration process. In addition, the PCAOB is seeking a collaborative approach to developing its oversight role vis-a-vis non-U.S. audit firms working with counterparts in Europe and elsewhere. We welcome continued input from the foreign issuer community as well as from our regulatory counterparts in other jurisdictions. In the short term, I expect several initiatives that should ease some of the concerns that foreign private issuers may have about the reforms now being implemented in the U.S. markets. First, I expect the SEC to consider whether there should be a new approach to the deregistration process for foreign private issuers if they do not feel prepared to meet the U.S. requirements. U.S. federal securities laws and regulations on this issue were designed many years ago before there was much in the way of cross-border listings. While the rules were designed to protect investors, we should seek a solution that will preserve investor protections without inappropriately designing the U.S. capital market as one with no exit. Sort of a roach motel, easy to get in, hard to get out. We recognize that issuer circumstances change and that foreign private issuers should have the flexibility to respond to these changes. Second, the Commission also recognizes the seismic change that conversion to IFRS represents for many European countries. We appreciate the European Union's efforts in this area because we value the EU's willingness to require the use of a single set of high-quality accounting standards. This approach enhances investor understanding throughout the world. We also understand that conversion to IFRS, while undoubtedly beneficial in the long run, could be difficult and expensive for some to implement in the immediate term. Consequently, the Commission has proposed amendments to our reporting requirements that will facilitate foreign private issuers' conversion to IFRS. For those foreign issuers also listed on U.S. exchanges, the SEC has long allowed these companies to use IFRS provided the financial figures were reconciled to U.S. GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, over a three-year period. Within the next few months, I fully expect the Commission will consider adopting a proposal to allow first-time users of IFRS to reconcile their financial statements to U.S. GAAP for only 2 years, and I am of the firm view this would be a step in the right direction, particularly insofar as the costs involved in three-year reconciliation are concerned. And third, the SEC recently extended the deadline for smaller accelerated filers in the U.S. Issuers in the U.S. with market capitalizations between $75 and $700 million to come into compliance with SEC rules implementing Section 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley. We pursued this course of action because we understand there are limited resources available to comply with these internal control requirements, which may be disproportionately expensive for companies with fewer resources to devote to compliance and their internal control. Though the Sarbanes-Oxley Act does not provide an exemption for foreign private issuers, we will continue to be sensitive to the need to accommodate unique foreign structures and requirements. Many non-U.S. companies and their auditors are well on their way to completing the processes necessary to report on internal controls. Of all the reforms contained in the Act, getting these processes right is likely to have the greatest long-term impact on enhancing the reliability of financial reporting. However, many companies outside the U.S., especially in Europe, face additional challenges in the near term that go above and beyond those faced by U.S. companies as European companies adopt international financial reporting standards for the first time in 2005. To address these burdens, I've asked the staff of the Commission to consider whether to recommend that we delay the effective date of the internal control or financial reporting requirements for non-U.S. companies. We will continue to monitor progress in these areas, and we're prepared to reach out and engage in an open dialogue to address concerns regarding reporting on internal controls. There are, of course, many other important issues looming on the international landscape, but the fundamental issue for everyone involved in the financial markets today, regardless of company or country, would be to maintain high standards, legal, regulatory, and ethical, that breed trust and confidence that must be at the core of our markets. This becomes increasingly important at a time when money managers can move capital around the world with just a few clicks on a computer. Capital will flee environments that are unstable or unpredictable, whether that's a function of lax corporate governance, ineffective accounting standards, a lack of transparency, or a weak enforcement regime. Investors must see for themselves that companies are living up to their obligations and embracing the spirit underpinning all the securities laws. Only then will the place of the world security markets and an engine of prosperity be assured in America, in Europe, and throughout the world. Thanks very much for this chance to speak to you all. I'm sure there are some questions and observations, and I'd be glad to take them. Thank you.
Thank you. Vivid language for a regulator, the Roach Motel. I think the message I got was we were going to switch from a Roach Motel to the Hotel California, where, of course, you can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. We'll take questions, and I'd be grateful if people could, first of all, wait for a microphone to be delivered to them by one of our assiduous stewards, and also to give a name and origin. And also state how many audit committees you sit on. Who would like to be? Who'd like to be first? Yeah, there's one right at the back with a pen. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Corey Bowles, Dow Jones. How long would you consider delaying the implementation of the of Section 404 for the foreign companies?
The current. Plan is for a period of it's already delayed from the already delayed period for another 4 or 5 months is the current plan.
There was one
thank you.
Red just in front.
Sylvia Ascarelli from the Wall Street Journal. When you're thinking about easing the ways for companies to deregister from the SEC, are you thinking in terms of increasing the number of U.S. shareholders are allowed to have without having to file with the SEC? Are you thinking of changing the methodology so it's perhaps based on how much trading is actually done on U.S. markets? Can you give us any insight on that?
Sorry, could you say that again? I think you swallowed the end, but maybe that's our microphone's fault.
What ways are you thinking of making it easier for companies to deregister with the SEC? Is it the number of U.S. shareholders they're allowed to have? Is it changing the way you decide who has to register based on
right.
percentage of trading done in the U.S., something else?
Yeah, it's a good question. We understand the problem. The problem is right now that you must be able to demonstrate that you can reduce your U.S. security holders to 300 or under. That's not easy to do, and clearly that was a rule that was installed many years ago when the size of companies and number of shares and so forth and the complexity of getting in and out was a lot less. We have not yet determined exactly how we're going to reduce that law, and we're working on it very hard right now. It's clear that some of the suggestions for doing that probably won't fly with us, such as the number of shares traded in a particular day or period of time. We don't think that's a particularly good measure, but we do have some thoughts on how we might lessen this restriction, and we will be reporting back to you and the rest of the world just as soon as we can. We're working very hard on it.
Thank you. Professor McPhee in the middle there, could you?
Thank you. Richard McVie, a professor of accounting here at the school. As I understand the US system, Chairman, the Financial Accounting Standards Board sets the accounting requirements under delegated authority from the SEC. You mentioned the reconciliation statement and your proposed concession on the number of years you might have to reconcile, but of course the basic issue is having to do the reconciliation at all. And with the advent of IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, how far ahead do you see it that there will actually be convergence between the requirements of IFRS and the requirements of US standards so that the reconciliation just ain't needed anymore?
Right. Well, the first step, as you mentioned, is for us to shorten the length of time going back for reconciliation, which is an expensive process, and it's particularly expensive when you're trying to adjust to IFRS at the same time. In terms of when we are going to reach the utopia that we all hope for, and I might say that we as a commission, along with the FASB, along with the International Accounting Standards Board are dedicated to convergence. And we are working in a number of fora. We're working with IOSCO. We're working with the Organization of International Security Regulators, CECOR, to get at this, to get at the convergence. There are obviously some major problems with convergence now, not just the regular problems that have been there all along, but with the advancement in security instruments and particularly derivatives. How one accounts for derivatives is a major issue. It is a major issue in so-called Section 39 of the proposed IFRS. It has not been resolved for the European Union yet. There are a lot of different ideas about how one goes about doing that, and that those ideas tend to come from where you sit as a company or a corporation or a bank or an insurance company. The pricing to market, the fair market value pricing, has a lot to do with the cyclicality of earnings, and that has a lot to do with problems in different sorts of industries. So we're working on this. We're working toward it. It is a goal. I think that the first steps have been taken. First steps are being taken right now in trying to work out Section 39. By the way, on our own side, just in our own U.S. GAAP, the Section 133, for those of you that follow this, is subject to a very different interpretation on our own side. You've seen evidence of that and some of the problems companies have had, Fannie Mae being the most recent example.
I'll take one from the cheap seats at the top of the second row there.
Paul Dare, no affiliation. In the UK, shareholders can nominate candidates for election to the board of directors and can then elect them. Is it likely that this practice will be adopted in the United States?
A hot button issue on our side. As of right now, the election of directors in the United States is basically mandated by state law. And the state law really creates a situation where you don't really have an election at all. You can only vote for a director candidate put up by the board on a board slate, or you can withhold your vote, which creates the situation, because they're plurality voting, creates the situation where of 100 voters, 99 can be against a director, and yet that director will be elected with one vote. That's a very difficult situation, and it creates an environment in which shareholders, and particularly large shareholders, who are forced to own a company forever, and that would be an index shareholder who owns a piece of a company and is going to hold it forever, or for an institutional investor that owns enough size, if you will, that they simply cannot buy or sell that block of stock. They're stuck with it. What do they do if they have objections to the way the company is being managed? What remedial action do they have? Right now, the only thing they can do is either sell their stock or start a proxy fight. So the issue becomes, what sort of access can shareholders have to get at least getting somebody on the management ballot, if you will, that represents the shareholders? This is an issue that faces us right now, and there are legitimate objections, if you will, to a proposal that we put forward a little less than a year ago, in which, in a rather convoluted way, we proposed for discussion a way of if there was enough dissent out there, a way for getting a shareholder person on the ballot alongside the management ballot. Not put them on the board, but to compete with the management ballot. That was a start to the thinking that we've hoped to create. You can make the case, I'll make the case, and I'll go back now to my original statement, which is what I'm about to say is my own view and not the view of the SEC. But if you have a 50% withhold ballot against a director, that seems to me to indicate that something ought to be done. That is something that cannot be ignored. Now, what the something is remains to be seen. And I believe the people on both sides of this argument have a legitimate worry. On the one side, the business community is worried that special interests, shareholder groups, will band together to place somebody on the board, and that person will become a special interest director. And not the kind of director that I think most companies are looking for, somebody that has all shareholder interests at heart. On the other hand, you have legitimate long-term investors, as I described, not special interest investors who want to get on the board for some purpose, but people who are genuinely concerned with making change at the company. And again, there's a conflict between these two groups, and I think our challenge is to figure out how to get at this fundamental problem. And what complicates it, it's a longer answer than you wanted, but it's a subject that is very much front and center in our country. We really have to rethink the whole situation, in my view, and it may be that it isn't just through the director election process. It may be that it's through other processes that get at affecting change where significant numbers of shareholders want it.
Thank you.
Woman down here with a blue shirt.
Paulina Magrorzi, the Nasdaq Stock Market and an alumni of the LSE. Chairman, I wonder if you can update us on the discussion about the regulation NMS. If you're in a position to do so. On the trading regulation, NMS?
NMS.
On the trading platform.
Oh, NMS.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, okay, sure. Sorry. National Market System, this is the name that we have put toward a series of changes that are on the docket for us now as to do with how the stock markets in our country are organized. As you all know, the preeminent market in the United States has been the New York Stock Exchange, and it has as its listees and does every day probably 80% of the volume in listed securities, New York Stock Exchange listed securities. that market has always been based on a concept of the protection of best price. And by that, I mean and they mean that if you have a bid or an offer out there, it's going to be protected, and anybody who wishes to buy or sell must honor that posted bid, the best bid or the best offer. Now, that has, and it's done in the stock exchange's case through an auction market. Through the years, and most particularly in the last 10 years, and even more particularly the last 5 years, there have arisen a category of trading mechanisms, electronic mechanisms, where the concept of best price is not their concept of the best execution. Their concept of the best execution has to do with the speed of the execution and with the integrity of the execution, and that means that when they go to trade, they don't get broken up by other purchasers or sellers of stock. And the complaint has been that the New York Stock Exchange's methodology is so slow that it takes 30 seconds for an electronic order to get to the market, to the floor of the market, and during that 30 seconds, markets change, other buyers and sellers come in, the specialists take part in the trade, et cetera, et cetera. So our problem in the new national market system we are proposing is to bring together the best of these two worlds, to protect the foundation concept of best bid or offer. And the reason we want to protect that is that markets are perform functionally, efficiently, the more posted prices you can put up there, the more people are willing to stick their neck out at a price and say, I'm willing to buy or sell at that price. Now, if you don't, and that in effect is a free option for somebody operating in the marketplace. You have an option to take that price. So in order to protect that, we must assure that bid or offer is to be honored. And we must make sure that some large institution doesn't trade, as they say, in the closet over here and leave that person hanging that put the bid out there. And we must protect that at the same time, recognize that speed, nanosecond kind of speed, and the ability to get a block of stock done in all at one time is important to institutional investors. So what we've come up with is a proposed national market system which will change the way stocks are traded. The most important aspect of this will be the electrification, if you will, of a large segment of the New York Stock Exchange, and the fact that it will be instantaneously responsive to any size order. And that will make the New York Stock Exchange totally competitive with these electronic markets. At the same time, the Stock Exchange, it will construct a parallel system where the old auction market and where other orders can be executed. The difference between these two systems will be that in the electronic system, orders will be protected via a trade-through rule. I don't mean to get too technical, but it means that you must operate in that electronic market and you cannot trade through it to another market. If you choose to put your order in to be handled in an auction environment in a so-called slow market, there will not be the protection of your bid or your offer. And that's your decision. And the reason you might make that decision is you might want to have a human being managing that order on the floor of an exchange. There are other aspects of NMS having to do with the fees that are charged, is preventing trading from taking place in under penny increments, and the whole way that fees are paid for the display on tapes of the trades, which are the four central parts of NMS. This proposal is revolutionary. It's been on the docket. The problems have been there for quite a while. We are going to move on it. We've been working on this for work has been done for many years intensively for the last year. We put out a proposal. We've modified that proposal. The closing period on that is today, as a matter of fact, and you'll see us moving on it very shortly.
Thank you. I've never heard anyone from the SEC describe brokers as human beings before. This is the new warm face of the commission. Gentleman here in the glasses in the room.
Tahir Majidi, a student at the IIM, MSc in Management. Just was wondering in regards to the dual listing strategy that the NASDAQ is planning to take forward. Are there any regulatory problems that you see coming through there? And also the trading volume, the NYC planning to start earlier for the trading, take the trading volume at LSE, the London Stock Exchange. Wanted to see whether you thought any problems with regards to that.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. I forgot to mention, under proposed NMS, NASDAQ will be brought under that same rule, the same protection of trade rule for an instantaneous market. As you know, the NASDAQ market has been through a substantial upgrading in the last period of time as trades stocks with high volumes in many ways equal efficiency or perhaps even greater efficiency in some instances in the New York Stock Exchange, but they will be brought under the same rule, and by that will imply that the trade-through issue, which the NASDAQ has not had to contend with, they will now have to contend with. So what we're doing, what we're saying is that there's no real reason why stocks, no matter where they're traded, shouldn't be traded by the same rules.
So, from the LSE, the overflow that's coming from the LSE, they're planning to do the NYC tank start earlier. Then, between the LSE and the NYC, through there?
Well, there are, you know, the whole issue of how dually listed stocks, listed, let's say, here in London and listed in and how they're traded by American brokers who have operations here in London and in New York is one that's been there all along. And again, there, if you don't bring it up, I'll bring it up. There have been some movement or urging on the part of foreign non-U.S. Markets that they put their trading screens in our country. We have resisted that because we have felt that we must have equal regulation in our country for our markets and markets that extend themselves into our country via the trading screen. Now, the national market system will change a lot of that, and it may well be that it will change our attitude toward trading screens. On the other hand, I was pleased to read a study by you all. I don't know whether any of the authors are here in the audience today, which took a hard look at trading screens and whether they would help or inhibit international trading and duly listed stocks. And the conclusion was that the markets have adjusted themselves without trading screens, and that it's entirely possible now to buy and sell UK securities, for instance, through a system that the brokers have worked out, through brokerage desks here in the UK at costs that are not any greater than would be if you had a trading screen. So it may become a mute question as we go on.
Thank you. Anyone else? Sorry, yes, one gentleman.
I was very interested to...
Sorry, could you tell me name?
Ian Johnson, LSE alumni and a former CFO of a US subsidiary in the UK. I've signed off 3 Sarbanes-Oxley certificates last year, so I have practical experience.
evidence of it. When I saw post Sarbanes-Oxley, I thought you were going to do away with Sarbanes-Oxley. My question really is, having signed them off, I got increasingly concerned about how impractical that act is. And in theory, I could have been extradited to the US to face criminal charges in the US, and I knew that what I was signing off was technically illegal because I wasn't complying with it. Not in any illegal way, but it's just impossible to comply. And I believed, to be perfectly honest, that I think people will withdraw from US markets because Sarbanes-Oxley, in a very complex financial world, with companies changing rapidly, and then being asked to sign quarterly certificates saying, you know everything that's happened in the last 3 months, and therefore you can sign it again. I just do not think that is practical for anybody to sign on a regular basis. Comment, well, please.
Let me respond to that, because I believe that the fundamental tenets within the Sarbanes-Oxley Act are very sound. The tenets that have to do with corporate governance, that have to do with the independence of directors, that have to do with a whole series of things that address the malfeasance, that address the accounting rinky-dinks, if you will, that went on in recent years, that caused the formation of the PCAOB to bring a new rigidity or clarity to auditing standards. I believe all of those are very sound principles, and I believe that we have learned that without those principles, we will not return to the kind of integrity that is demanded of our financial statements. Now, having said that, if you take a subsection of Sarbanes-Oxley, particularly the 404 subsection, which has to do with management signing off on the adequacy of their internal controls, again, there's a cost benefit to that. There we are in the cost side of this equation, where it's expensive now to go through the accounts and get the kind of clarity to the controls that is needed. By the way, many of our companies are finding that clarity is something that management should have had in the first place. There's a reassurance to the top management, and a reassurance is being enforced by severe penalties if you sign off on the statements and they're not correct. Some of the heads of some of our largest companies have found out things that were going on down in the depths of that company that they should have known about and will do something about. Having said that, I believe the benefit side of Sarbanes-Oxley will come not only from that managerial tool aspect of it, but also from the believability and credibility of the numbers that come out of companies for the future. And I think you're going to see fewer write-offs, fewer adjustments, et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately, if that's true, we're going to see a higher price earnings multiple on stocks. And that's the benefit side. Now, having said all of that, it's clear that we need to take a look at some of the details of Sarbanes-Oxley that can be improved. For instance, the one-size-fits-all aspect of Sarbanes-Oxley. We are applying the same principles to large companies and small companies, and clearly a small company has, if it has a charge of $1 million or $2 million to get its accounts in order and to attest to its the veracity of those accounts, that's a big charge, and that's a big cost. And so we've formed, right now, just as I sit here, we are forming, and we've announced this, an advisory, a blue chip advisory committee made up of small company owners who will advise us on how we might be able to make adjustments in the cost structure and the mandates for smaller companies. And I suspect as we go on and as we work with this law, that there will be other instances, maybe in large companies, where we can improve the efficiency of the act. But the fundamental thrust of the act is being proven time and time again how necessary it was.
Thank you. We've got time for one or two more. I think we'll take that second row with the stripy shirt.
Farhan Islam, student here at Government Economics. I just wanted to get your views on the takeover bid for the LSE, and how do you think a consolidated exchange would affect the New York Exchange, and would it lead to companies sort of being drawn more towards Europe than the U.S.?
The proposed consolidation of LSE with Frankfurt or wherever. Yeah. I think I probably better stay out of that one. Having said that, I think, without getting myself too far out on a limb, in our country we have excess capacity in our exchange capacity. We have a lot of exchanges in the United States, and I think you'll probably see some consolidation there. I don't mean to imply that there's too much excess capacity here in Europe or in London or in Frankfurt. It gets to the concept of what makes for a good market. And you can go at it in two ways. You can have competition between exchanges constantly competing to be a better market. But the best market is competition between buyer and seller. And it's a trade-off between that. I mean, the best market is if you could aggregate all buyers and sellers for a stock and put them together, that would be the market clearing mechanism. But you want to have, at the same time, you want to have competition for exchanges, between exchanges, for methods and ways of trading. So to put together two exchanges, I think you're going to have to look at both aspects of that, whether in fact there are efficiencies that can come from it, or are there going to be inefficiencies that will result from perhaps less innovation? And that's my answer. I don't have an answer to whether it's good or bad.
Thank you. I think we'll just have one more and over here. Thank you.
Hello. My name is Hatsiyanis. I work for Investment Bank NBG. National Bank of Greece. The question I want to ask you is, do you have some experience whether large fines that have been put towards investment banks in the past have been sufficient to deter them from winning investment banking from positive research analysis that they have procured? And following that, do you think that the investors are more confident now to believe this research?
I think that it was clear that research had become a handmaiden of investment banking in the latter half of the 90s in our country. I think it was clear that when negotiated commissions came in and commissions were reduced to pennies, that the compensation for pure research was reduced to almost nothing. And we all have big research departments, and how are we going to put them to work? We're going to put them to work as sales agents for the investment banking side of the house. And again, personal view, research became much more statistical, less valuable, more predictive of earnings, pennies per share, quarter to quarter, than it did real analysis and real research. This brought this whole situation under the purview of the SEC and the state regulators. We had the so-called global settlement, which enforced the separation of research and the investment banking business. It also set up a situation in which research could be accomplished not connected at all, not within a firm, an investment banking firm, but a freestanding research. Now, how's that working? I think it's too early to tell. My view is that good research, which is not just statistical reporting, but is real value-added research that makes a difference between a true understanding of a company and a willingness, therefore, to invest in it, is worth a lot of money. And the question is whether that kind of research, and that's going to be very different than what has been produced as a byproduct of an investment banking firm, that's going to be a very different kind of research. I think it's a great market opportunity, by the way, to produce that. But I think it's too early to tell whether it's working that way. Certainly, in theory, it should.
Thank you. I'm afraid we haven't reached the end of our time. And I feared when we got to the LSE Deutsche Börse question that it was only a matter of time before we had a question of whether you support Tony Blair or Gordon Brown or some other domestic matter which you might wish to keep out of. So I think we will draw it to a close there. I'd just like to say that we are delighted and honoured that you chose to come to the LSE to make a speech in London. It was a fascinating speech, and we particularly appreciated the open way in which you addressed such a broad range of questions.
I thank you very much. I must say, as I said at the beginning, the London School of Economics is a name that I know and recognize and are respected for years. So for me, it's a great pleasure to be invited to come here. Thanks very much.
Thank you.